Welcome back to Tabu. My name's Katrina. Today I'm joined by Nick Russell and Daniel Fireman. Can I ask you guys to introduce yourself, Nick?
I can, although you did a half job. I'm Nick Russell. I'm the sales director at Tab.
And I'm Daniel Fireman. I'm a solicitor at Gunner Cook.
Great. And today our special guest is solicitor. So we're going to be talking about real estate finance solicitors, what their role is in the lending process, what they do, and basically just going to grill you about what you do for Tab and anyone else.
Sure.
If we kick things off with, quite simply, what is your main role when acting for a lender?
Well, there are three principal roles. The main concern really is to ensure that we get the money out safely for the lender and that they can get it back. And in the course of doing that, first, we look into the borrower. We do our due diligence. We make sure that the borrower is the person that we intend to lend to, and there's nothing dodgy about the borrower. Then we look at the property in detail. Look at the property, but we make sure it's going to be a good security for the loan. And finally, we prepare the loan and security documents, make sure they reflect the terms that have been offered to the borrower, and make sure that the loan is going to be properly secured on the property and with any guarantee or any other security that the lender wants.
What time are you involved, or what stage of the process are you involved? Is it kind of, so Nick brings in a deal, mm-hmm. Do you get looped in at that point, or, you know, what stage you included? And yeah,
well, quite simply, it all depends on a deal. It changes from deal to deal. If it's a complex deal, very often we're consulted at an early stage, not just because the lender wants to get a take on what the fees might be, but just to work out precisely how the loan is going to be structured and to talk it through, so we all know exactly what we're going to present to the borrower and to his introducing broker. So very often, we will simply be presented with instructions when all the loan underwriting has been carried out, and told, this is the deal, give us a quote, and please go ahead and contact the borrower's solicitors and make sure
let
that
us know when it's done.
Out. Yeah. Sometimes we approach at a much earlier stage if it's a complex deal, as I said, and then we might perhaps talk through how we're going to do it.
And when you say the loan structuring, what does that actually mean for our listeners and me?
Okay. Well, it all depends on the nature of the borrower proposition and the property proposition. Sometimes you get borrowers who wish to borrow money, but they want to secure the loan against property that isn't necessarily in their name. And so we have to structure it in such a way that the borrower is the person borrowing the money from us, and the person who owns the property provides the security for the borrower. Very often we have to look at different ways of facilitating the loan terms, how we arrange the payment of interest, how we deal with all sorts of issues that can crop up and which vary in almost every single situation, because no two loans are the same, albeit we're always lending money to borrowers who own property, secured on that property. Every single proposition is different.
And ultimately, who do you work for? Is it the lender, the borrower, the underwriters?
We act for the lender. Our role is very clear. It's to make sure that the lender gets their money out safely and they can get their money back. We take whatever steps need to be taken to ensure that's the case.
And why is it that funds have to go through solicitors? Why could I not just transfer, not me, obviously, but the lender not just go straight to the borrower's account? It obviously has to go through the solicitors. Can it go through you to borrower, or does it have to go through you to their solicitors?
It's almost invariably the case that the money comes to us from the lender. We send the money, or the net loan advance, to the borrower's solicitor, and the borrower's solicitor sends that money on to the borrower. And there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, firstly, we need to make sure that we know exactly where the money's going and that we need to safeguard the interests of the lender and the lender's funders. Secondly, we need to have the comfort that the borrower's solicitor has carried out all their know-your-client and money laundering due diligence against the borrower, and they confirm that that's the case to us. So we know that by providing that money to them, we're not sending our money into the abyss. the likelihood is that it will get to the person who it's supposed to go to, and then we'll be able to get it back if we need to, when we need to.
Great. And I guess that my question was, off the back of that, was going, do I need a solicitor if I'm taking a bridging loan? But I guess given that what we just
discussed. Answer is absolutely yes. There are very few bridging lenders in the commercial space, the commercial bridging space, which is specialist finance, who will lend to a borrower that doesn't have a solicitor. In the case of regulated lending, where you're lending to people to people who own houses directly, or they live in those houses, or they're letting them out, then very often you can get dual representation, meaning that the same lawyer represents both the lender and the borrower. But it's quite rare in the TAB space.
Is that something you offer?
It's not. No, I firmly believe that if you're a lender's lawyer, you're a lender's lawyer, and it's best not to act for the borrowers as well in any situation.
Can we just touch on another thing? So in terms of fees and moving money around, can you explain to everyone what undertaking of fees means?
Yes. Sometimes deals don't always go the way you want them to, and for reasons perhaps a valuation doesn't come in at what it should be, or circumstances change, a loan can't proceed. But very often, by that stage, the solicitor acting for the lender will have done a considerable amount of work. They'll have done borrower and property due diligence. They may have drafted documents. So pretty much the standard approach is to request an undertaking from the borrower solicitor so that they will meet the lender solicitor's legal fees up to a certain amount in the event that the deal doesn't go ahead.
Question two, what do you look out for when looking at cases?
We work closely with the underwriters in most cases. They present us with the bare bones of the case, the details of the borrower, the details of the property. And we then drill down deep and make sure, firstly, as I said before, the borrower is who they're supposed to be. And then we look at the property and we carry out effectively the same type of investigations that you do when you're buying a property. And we make sure that the title is good, that the borrower actually owns the property. We look into any matters that affect the title, so there can be restrictive covenants saying you can't do certain things on a property. There can be rights that you need in order to get to the property or to get out of the property. There can be other matters that affect the property. We look at who might occupy the property and the terms on which they occupy the property. Effectively, we look at anything that might affect the ability of the lender in the hopefully unlikely event that it has to enforce its loan, anything that might affect its ability to recover possession of the property or to sell the property and recover its money.
And then I guess what checks do you do that underwriters do not? Are there any, or is it the same ones?
And how much of those checks are really related to fraud checks, which is obviously one of the biggest dangers to our industry?
Well, fraud is something that we're on the lookout on every case, and what there tends to be when there's something dodgy going on is there tends to be some sort of red flag alerts, which we would expect to identify. We wouldn't necessarily identify anything any quicker than an underwriter, but we would always look at everything on the assumption that, is there anything to be worried about here? Is there anything that any possible concern? And there are things, for instance, whenever you do a loan secured on a property that's unencumbered, in other words, there's no existing mortgage on it, you really want to make sure that your borrower is not an imposter who has just found out, and it does happen, who has found out that this is the property that's unencumbered, they have purported to be the owner of the property, they may have obtained a false passport and false proof of their own address at that property, and they then may then pursue the loan as though they are the borrower, when in fact they're an imposter. And they may have hoodwinked their solicitors into believing they are who they say they are. And so we make sure, as far as we possibly can, that we cover those angles, and we absolutely make sure that the borrower's solicitors will certify the identity of their client, that they're comfortable, that they've carried out all requisite checks and make sure that they know that their client is who they say they are, and they genuinely are the owners of, or will be the owners of, and the providers of security against that property that is all important to the lender.
Has that sort of scenario come up more because of COVID and kind of people not being able to meet in person and having Zooms, is it easier? Or has that always been about?
And I would say it's more difficult these days to perpetrate a mortgage fraud because there are so many more checks and balances that one has to look at. In the past, requirements weren't quite as heavy in terms of lenders' instructions to their lawyers for what to look out to. I think the prevalence of fraud hasn't particularly increased. And if anything, people are much more wary now, much more vigilant now than they ever have been. But then again, it's very difficult to prevent a really determined and smart fraudster.
And when you do find something risky or, you know, that doesn't look right, who do you go to? Is it the lender you're saying, look, we've come up with this? Is it
we flag it to the client immediately as soon as we think there's anything to be worried about, and it can be at a very early stage. We immediately say to the client, look, you've got to look into this, you've got to think about that, and make sure that there is nothing untoward.
Is there anything, kind of any chats with their solicitor, kind of be like, look, we've spotted this, can you explain it, can you go, or is
absolutely
it,
yeah,
stick
I
with
mean, yeah, certainly we would always raise any concerns that we have with the borrower solicitors. I mean, it's quite possible that they may be totally unaware that there's a potential problem. And so, yeah, we would share it with them. We've generally got nothing to hide. We want to simply want to make sure that effectively we can all do the jobs we're there to do. And for them, it's to represent a genuine borrower.
How do you balance that with tipping off?
Sorry?
How do you balance that with tipping off? Because obviously with money laundering and all the rest of it, you can't tip off the fact that you know something. So, well, we can't as lenders, right? There's the whole money laundering training that we have to go through to make sure that, you know, we're aware of what's going on. If we think anything is, as you use the word, dodgy, then we need to report that. How does that work in terms of your responsibility to report that, but also not tipping off their lawyer to tip off the client if something is going on?
Well, we would never intentionally tip off a lawyer that we're looking into their client's bona fides to make sure they're genuine. At the same time, my position has always been that it is highly likely that the borrower's lawyer will know exactly where we're coming from when we raise any concerns. And whilst they can't tip off their own client, they probably will have told their own client at the very outset that they are under certain obligations, reporting obligations, and to give them the general flavour of those obligations that might exist. So their client would have had an opportunity to know and be aware of what might be going on if suddenly they can't get the kind of information they're looking for. But certainly we wouldn't do anything to precipitate a tipping off.
Well said, Daniel.
But we would certainly share with you as the lender any concerns that we might have so they can be addressed.
And going on to question three, what is a rot? So I hear this kind of being spoken about in the office, just kind of like, oh, it's been returned. I'm like, what is this? It's an ROT as well, isn't it? Or is it a rot?
It's an ROT.
It is an ROT, but we all call it rot in the office because, you know, there's so many of them going on that it's the easiest way to have to say report on title every single time.
There you go. What does it stand for?
So it stands for report on title. And it's a report that the lender's lawyer will prepare, which looks at the title to the property that is the security, identifies all the relevant issues in that title, tells the lender whether it's freehold or leasehold, if it's registered, what the title number is at the land registry. It tells them about any matters that are contained in the title that might impact the property. So if it's subject to leases, then it will explain that it's subject to leases, and it will set out a summary of the terms of those leases. If it's a leasehold property itself, then it will set out a summary of the terms of that lease. If there are any covenants, for instance, if there's something on the title that says the borrower can't use the property for anything other than a single dwelling house, then we'll communicate that. Access rights, if the property is on a road that's not a public roadway, it's not an adopted roadway, then we'll make sure that there's a right of way to and from the property over private land. And anything else that might be of interest to anyone who either owns a property or wants to be able to sell a property in the future, we'll identify. So it's anything that might adversely impact the value of the property or the marketability of the property or the opportunity to mortgage the property.
Hence why once we get a draft, rot, we then send it straight to the valuer who's valued the property, so they can then check that against their valuation to make sure that anything that our solicitors or lawyers have reported within the report and title don't adversely affect the valuation, because that it's not fully signed off the valuation until they've received that. If the valuer says, no, that's fine, then we can proceed with the valuation. Alternatively, they could say, okay, we didn't know about this based on the fact there's an overage payment from a previous owner. There could be an access point. We're now going to have to drop 10%. Then that could then go on and affect our loan, which we might then have to reduce as a result of the final valuation.
And the report on title, is there such a document that you would do on the borrower? Like, is there a report on borrower?
There's a rob. Not a great word for lending.
There's not necessarily a specific report on the borrower, but it depends on how sophisticated the borrower structure is, if you like. If you're lending to individuals and they're UK passport holders, then there's usually not a great deal to say. If it's a UK limited company and we know who the directors and shareholders are, then we would set those. We might set those out in a brief summary. But certainly when it's the case that you have complex ownership structures, perhaps offshore structures where you've got maybe a Channel Islands or a BVI company owning the property, then we have to really look in detail at how the ownership of the property is ultimately structured, who the ultimate beneficial owners are. We have to deal with lawyers in the jurisdictions of the company, the company's incorporation, to make sure that that company is able to borrow the money and to offer security over the money, and that we will be able to enforce the loan against that company if we have to. And so it can become a lot more complex. And in that case, we will do a more detailed report, and we obtain also a legal opinion for the lender from the lawyer in the jurisdiction, who will treat the lender as their client, and will explain to them how the fact that the borrower is an offshore entity might impact their loan, and will also be able to present that report to the Land Registry, who will then register the foreign borrower as the owner of the property, which otherwise they wouldn't necessarily do. They want the comfort of knowing that foreign borrower is entitled to own property and to grant security of property.
Do you see a decent percentage of loans for offshore borrowers? I know we do a few here and there, just throwing that in there.
I do. I mean, I expect that probably at least 1 in 10 of the loans that I'm completing for lenders will be to offshore entities, or there'll be an offshore element somewhere along the line within that transaction.
And what other documents are produced by you guys for the lender? So we've got the ROT, a brief summary on the borrower.
Facility agreement.
Agreements. What's the facility?
Well, principally,
PG.
Yeah, well, principally the other documents are security or security related. So we'll prepare the mortgage. We'll prepare a debenture if it's a corporate borrower. Sometimes that incorporates the mortgage on the property. We'll prepare the personal guarantees because usually when there are corporate borrowers, some sort of personal guarantee, either limited or unlimited, is required. We'll prepare any other security that the lender tells us they want. They might want a charge over shares, or if it's a development loan, they might want collateral warranties from the contractor or the architect or the consulting engineer. And we'll also prepare other ancillary documents. For instance, we always need to know that the borrower and any guarantors have had independent legal advice. So they might use the same firm of lawyers, but we would usually want them to use a separate lawyer to advise a person in their capacity as, say, guarantor, or someone who's offering a third-party charge over a property that they own for the security of the loan to the borrower. So we prepare the certificates that have to be signed by solicitors confirming they've given the advice to those third parties. And
they're referred to ILA.
They're referred to as ILA certificates, independent legal advice certificate.
I was about to ask.
Yeah. No problem.
And we also get the solicitors who actually give the advice to sign those off, and we also get the borrowers to countersign them, or the person to whom the advice has been given to countersign them, just to confirm they've had the advice, they understood the nature and effect of the advice. It's just another comfort for the lender. And then we also prepare corporate authorities. So a company has to mandate its acts through board resolutions and decisions made by the directors. Mm-hmm. So we prepare those documents and make sure that they reflect the nature of the loan and the security that the borrower is taking, so that they properly recorded it within their constitutional books.
Cool.
Very succinct. Very succinct, Tom.
I've got no other questions. No more questions. No, I do. Now, this is a small tab plug for briefly. So you guys recently completed a loan in 48 hours with TAB. Well done, team. But my question is, what are the challenges that can come up with certain time pressures like 48 hours or less, more?
Well, the important thing about trying to get a deal done within a very short time frame is that everyone's putting together in the same direction. So all of the counterparties involved, whether they're representing the borrower or the lender, have to be there, they have to be active, they have to be proactive, they have to be reactive. And if they all work together, then you can get deals done and turn around very, very quickly. It helps a great deal when the borrower's representatives are knowledgeable. So a broker who really understands the market, who understands the nature of the deal, that's essential. And a solicitor who's used to transactional work, who understands the requirements of lenders and acts for the borrower and can explain to the borrower what they want is very helpful. And of course, nothing beats an experienced borrower who's done this before time and time again and understands that rather than argue about issues that it starts to deal with,
doesn't it question everything that's requested of them.
And accept that there are questions that the lender needs answered, which have to be dealt with. They have to be addressed. They're not going to be swept under the carpet. And that they just produce the answers to us as and when we want them. And then we can get the deal done in double quick time.
Yeah, I think also you've got to add in there that the valuer needs to be on board as well, because either the valuation had to have been done, or in the case of this particular deal that we did, we had to get a retype, which means the valuation was done for someone else, and we had to get it retyped into our name so that we could lean on the valuer's PI over the time span of the loan. Fortunately, we were able to turn that around within 6 hours with that valuer, very motivated valuer. So it took everyone, as you said, on the deal, lender, lawyers, valuers, borrowers. And on top of that, we had a borrower in Switzerland, the lender and lawyers in the UK. We had the purchase was a BVI, which for anyone who doesn't know, British Virgin Isles
shares. The seller was a BVI.
Sorry?
The seller was also a BVI. The
seller was a BVI, but they lived in Hong Kong.
Oh, my gosh.
So we had about the entire globe's time zones all wrapped up into this deal at the same time.
How many people were on the conference call?
Probably about 10.
Yeah. 10?
Yeah.
That's a lot of muting. Yeah. Shut up, Nick. And I guess what's the most common factor that can cause delays? Is it quite simply just people not working in sync together?
Borrowers, lawyers.
it's not always borrowers, lawyers. That's not true. I mean, the most common factor is simply the fact that it sometimes takes a while to collate all the information and documents that you need in order to get deals done. I mean, there are other factors like pressure of work for all the people who are involved, who are probably not just handling one deal at any one time and can't necessarily work 24/7. So I think it is true that, and perhaps they're much maligned, that borrowers' solicitors sometimes do come in for a lot of criticism. But the reality of it is that some of them are excellent and respond very, very quickly. And really, it's sometimes when the borrower may have made an ill-informed choice of lawyer. For instance, they might have used their local conveyancer or the local high street practitioner, thinking they can help them out in the normal way. And sometimes that's not the most effective way of getting the deal done, because if they're familiar with this type of transaction, then they're always going to be able to operate quickly, and that will help us get the deal across the line as soon as possible. I mean, the trick here really is you have to get from A to B in the quickest possible route, but without cutting any corners.
Of course.
So every single check has to be carried out. It doesn't matter if you're completing a deal in one day or in 2 months. You've nevertheless got to make sure that every single angle has been covered.
Can I just add one more thing on that deal? That Daniel was actually in Spain on holiday and worked 24 hours a day while he was in Spain working. So we need to mention that part.
Go on,
as well.
Daniel.
Thank you.
Flat all cases. You can always find him if you need him.
At Picasso's.
That kind of leads us nicely into kind of how did you become a bridging finance solicitor or get into this sector?
Well, I kind of fell into it. I mean, I'd always been acting for lenders of one kind or another, a lot of banks, and many years ago for bridging lenders. And then for quite some time, I was the managing partner of my law firm, so I didn't really have that much opportunity to find new areas to practice. So I always kept my hand in looking after lenders. And then after the financial crash in 2008, 2009, a lot of new bridging lenders started just emerging to fill the gap where the banks weren't able to operate anymore. And I found myself offering advice very similar to the advice I'd offered decades before to similar types of lender. And I felt that for someone like me, this was a good opportunity to actually build up a niche. And I eventually merged my law practice with another much bigger firm and then took over the banking and real estate finance team at that firm and built that up, at the same time just focusing on acting for lenders. And so since 2014, I've done nothing but act for lenders on secured lending transactions. And some of them are small bridging lenders and development funders. Some of them have been challenger banks. Some of them have been major clearing banks and international banks.
Is it more complicated than other types of lending? Or does it?
It is. Well, it's secured lending is secured lending, effectively. We tend not to delve into the most sophisticated type of bank lending. or even the most sophisticated type of real estate finance, because the nature of our clients is such that they don't require the most sophisticated loan documentation or the most sophisticated reports. So it is probably amongst the more basic of lending operations, but nevertheless, every single deal...
How do you think I got a job in this industry?
Every deal presents a risk. In every single case, you have to make sure that the borrower proposition and the property proposition is good and that the documentation is sound.
Yeah, ultimately, we're asset-backed lending, right? There's no, you know, we're not looking at income of the property. We're not looking at, you know, weighted average, you know, unexpired lease terms on certain assets as to, you know, the income diminishing. We're not looking at cash sweeps on anything. We're, you know, we're keeping things pretty simple.
Generally, you're not. Although bridging lenders are becoming more sophisticated and they are sometimes now looking at propositions that they would never previously have looked at. It used to be simply a question of, what's the loan to value? Can we get our money back if we have to sell the property? But there are other factors that come in now, particularly when you look at what the exit strategy is for the borrower to ensure that they can actually refinance or sell or do whatever else they need to get their money back.
We're definitely more borrower conscious, especially as we started to move into larger loans. I think when you're lending those sort of sums of money, I think it's all very well saying, okay, the property this, the property that, but when you're sitting in a meeting with someone, you're looking at the whites of their eyes, you want to know that person actually wants to get your money back. Typically, those people as well have other assets, so you're not all solely relying on one asset potentially, just as your sole way of redemption. So, yeah, I think it's become more and more. I know there are a lot of lenders out there that will say, we're asset-backed lending, we don't care about the borrower. I just think that is a crazy... You leave yourselves well open just to, you know, for complications down the line, because you may rely on the property, but you also got to deal with the person behind it when you're actually trying to get your money back, and you want to deal with more, you know, proper people who are going to be as good on the way out as they were on the way in.
Yeah, well, that's particularly the case when you're lending to businesses that are operating from the property that you're taking as security, because they will often look at different types of exit route. They might look at conventional bank facilities to take you out rather than another commercial lender or a sale exit. And so you've got to make sure that you're comfortable that business can continue to deliver so they can get that exit when they need it. So there are lots of things that I think that bridging lenders are looking at now, which traditionally they wouldn't have been concerned with.
Is that something you look at as well, the exit, or is that the underwriter's job?
Well, everything that we're doing is geared towards making sure that the lender will get their money back.
Yeah.
So whilst to us it doesn't make a lot of difference if there's a refinance or a sale, or some other method of
what's
repayment.
What's the most unusual method you've
Well, we have to make sure... Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm sure there is one. But I can't think of anyone putting the property in a lottery or anything like that, or raffling it off. But those kind of things can happen.
Lowest bid wins.
Yeah, we do look at making sure that if that property has to be disposed of or refinanced, there's nothing that's going to impact the ability to do that, as far as we can tell.
And I guess what's the most complicated case you can think of right now that you've ever worked on?
It's difficult to say, really. I mean, I suppose the most complicated cases are usually the cases that involve share sales, where you've got a borrower who's buying the shares in a company that owns a multitude of properties. And it's not so much they're complex as that logistically they are complicated to deal with, because there can be numerous different factors you have to look at to make sure that all the ducks are in a row, so that at the time you release your money, it's completed. The ownership of the target company changes to your borrower. The securities are put in place. That all the steps that have to occur up to that moment are done by the previous owners of the property, and then simultaneously, almost or immediately subsequent to that share purchase, you've then got to make sure that all the securities are put in place and everything goes into the name of the new borrower, and then you've got to carry out all the usual registration formalities. Whether or not it's that complicated depends on the number of properties involved, number of entities involved, and how competent, really, the professionals representing all the parties are. And if everyone's doing what they've got to do, then generally you can get everything through, no matter how complicated.
How many deals do you look at any one time?
Currently, I'm never working on more than about 10 deals at any one time.
10?
I would say.
Wow.
And some of those deals might be deals that are going to take 2 to 4 weeks to complete. Yeah, yeah. Some of them are deals that will have to be completed within a matter of days. But I have a team of other lawyers who I'm working with. It's not by any means all carried out by me. Very often I'll do the banking work and another lawyer or lawyers will do the property work. And we just work together and coordinate together. So it's very difficult for one person to handle a number of deals at any one time on their own, particularly when there are large sums of money involved and lots of properties.
Yes, it can get quite that could get complicated because there's just so many things you need to think about. I guess, have you got any predictions on where you see the specialist lending sector going?
Well, certainly for the last few years, it's been growing. And I've seen lenders come and go. And the ones that know what they're doing and have got a good source of deal flow are still going and doing very well. I haven't seen the appetite of the banks to come back into this market to the extent that I thought there would have been, although I think some of the banks now are beginning to look again at stepping back into the territory that the bridging lenders have claimed. So we might see some pressure. At the same time, interest rates generally are going up at the moment, but bridging lenders haven't necessarily been putting their rates up at the same level. And so it's almost like the gap is now beginning to close between the traditional lenders and the bridging lenders, which is unusual and possibly only short term. But that means that the bridging lenders are still, because they're able to operate that much quicker, they're much more fleet of foot when it comes to delivering quickly. They don't have to wait months for credit committees to make decisions. And so there's still very much a very, very busy market, and there's some very hungry borrowers for whom time is money. And the quicker they get their money, even if it's at a cost, the better, because that enables them to do the deal they couldn't otherwise have done.
Yeah, and just remember that half of these lenders are funded by these high street banks anyway. So if their rates go up, the bridging lenders' rates are going to go up anyway. So I think the way they've got into this space more, the high street banks, is actually just fund the people that are funding it in the first place. That means they can distribute more cash on a larger scale rather than be so granular. And they get the granularity through the loan book of all the lenders they lend to. So I don't know if they will jump straight in as a sort of principal lender to borrower. I think they've probably found it easier to provide wholesale funding to people who actually can manage these loans.
I think so, and they're also getting the loan-to-value ratios that they want. Sometimes
their advance rates mean they're even better positioned they would be lending themselves.
The funding lender will often be taking first loss, which means there's a fair degree of protection for the funder to that lender. But at some point, one expects that the banks will begin to bring in people who are trained to actually understand the business of this nature, and they'll get back into the market. Mm. So, I mean, but for the foreseeable future, I see the bridging industry as continuing and only continuing to grow.
You think there'll be a time where the banks come back into the market where the property affordability is not taken into account like bridging lenders do?
It's possible. I mean, obviously, you're talking about the unregulated market.
So yeah,
you will never get that in a regulated market. And if regulation doesn't creep in to the unregulated arena, then it may well be that the banks will be prepared to lend on a, say, retained interest basis, which I don't believe we've seen before with traditional lending. But it's only because you're lending on a retained basis or a rolled-up interest basis that you don't have to be concerned with the affordability, and by its very nature, that kind of lending has to be short term.
Cool. Well, let's go on to the last question. And if you can give our listeners one golden tip to get into finance, I guess what would it be? If I'm a borrower and I want to get the finance, what would it be?
Very simple. Always cooperate. Whatever the lender asks, just do it. Ask your solicitors, please. Whatever the lender's solicitors ask you to do, please just do it. That will get us across the line.
Please.
That will get us across the line sooner rather than later. And it always will, because we don't ask questions because we don't need to know the answer. We ask them because we do need to know the answer. And the quicker we have the answer, the quicker we move on to the next matter, and the quicker we can get the deal done for you.
And pick the right lawyer.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Daniel. It's been really interesting. I mean, that adds a lot of light onto why I see your name everywhere and I'm constantly asking you for quotes because I'm like, so thanks for coming in. And
You're welcome.
Thanks, Nick,
My pleasure.
For coming back.
Well hosted, Katrina, as always.
Thanks to all our listeners. See you next time. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, comment. See you next time.